From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Carter Page, the investment banker and former foreign policy advisor to Donald Trump, has responded to today's Washington Post report that the FBI obtained a warrant to investigate whether Page was actually an agent for Russia. Page said he finds the report very encouraging because it shows he's a scapegoat. Carter Page goes on to compare himself to Martin Luther King, who was also investigated by federal officials. The Washington Post report that the FBI went to a FISA court and obtained a FISA warrant to monitor the communications of Page, a U.S. citizen. Josh Meyer is a senior investigative reporter for Politico. Josh, we should say there have been no charges, although the Post is reporting the FISA warrant was renewed. You spoke with Carter Page last night when this report came out. Tell us more about what he said.
Well, Robin, he does say that he welcomes the investigation and the FISA warrant. He says that it will prove that he's the victim of some sort of political scapegoating, and that it's very encouraging because there had been prior reports about this, but he was so happy to hear that further confirmation is now being revealed, confirmation that is that he's being the victim of a political investigation.
And as you write, we know that FBI Director James Comey and others have gone out of their way to tell people that it's very difficult to get a FISA warrant. There's layers of requests and requirement that people have to go through. Comey feels it's impervious to politics.
Right. It is. I mean, what Page said specifically is that it, quote, shows how low the Clinton-Obama regime went to destroy our democracy and suppress dissidents who did not fully support their failed foreign policy. But, you know, any expert about FISA knows that it is one of the most locked down systems in the federal government in terms of really needing a tremendous amount of just cause and evidence in order to get the warrant. As Comey noted in his congressional testimony, most of the FISA warrant applications are as thick as his wrist. So it's a tremendous amount of information. And it does really require them to show probable cause that somebody is an agent of a foreign power or that they're knowingly aiding or abetting a person who is engaged in those kinds of conduct.
This very much changes the narrative so far. It was the Trump administration that first came out and claimed that they were being wiretapped by President Obama. And then we saw that intelligence release that actually showed that, in fact, they were just swept up in normal intelligence gathering. They were part of communications maybe with, you know, Russian officials maybe, but not directly targeted. This would be a direct target. Tell us more about Carter Page and why he might be targeted by the FBI.
You know, Carter Page is one of a handful of Trump associates that did have very significant ties with the Russians. I mean, he lived in Russia for several years, about 15 years ago. He routinely boasts about his connections with very high-level Russian authorities and other people in the energy consulting business. He's made several trips there. He's also spoken very, very critically of the U.S. government and its policy and in favor of Russia. So there's a lot of smoke there and a lot of things that the feds are investigating.
Well, the Washington Post reports that 3 years before Page was an advisor to the Trump campaign, he did come to the attention of FBI counterintelligence agents because of Russian spy suspects who had sought to use Page as a source for information. There were, in one case, a Russian posing as a diplomat. He was later charged by federal prosecutors with acting as an unregistered agent, was captured on a tape in 2013 talking about Page. So there are these puzzle parts, but Page himself has been very inarticulate in responding to questions about whether or not he's spoken with Russians. Let's listen to an exchange with Chris Hayes.
You told one reporter I had no meetings with the Russians. Now you're telling me I had no meetings with the Russians about the things they were talking about. I'm just trying to get a straight answer. Like, did you meet Sergei Kislyak in Cleveland? Did you talk to him?
I'm not going to deny that I talked with him.
Although so you did talk to him.
I will say that I never met him anywhere outside of Cleveland. Let's just say that much.
The only time that you met him was in Cleveland.
I may have met him, possibly, might have been in Cleveland.
So, Josh Meyer, tell us more about what Carter Page has said to you about his interactions with Russians.
Well, you know, it's sort of like trying to put your finger in mercury. Whenever you really try to sort of get any traction there, it sort of moves around on you. I mean, I think his answers have been very evasive. He's never actually answered the specific questions of who he's spoken to and what those conversations entailed. We wrote a story a few weeks ago about how he did meet at least once with the Russian ambassador during the Republican convention last summer. He's made several trips to Russia. He denied in conversations with me that he met with Igor Sechin, who is a top Putin aide and the head of Rosneft, which is the Russian state-owned oil company. And he's also been sanctioned by the U.S. government, which makes it illegal to talk to him. And Page denied meeting with Sechin, but he did not he would not comment on whether he has met with other sanctioned individuals in past years. So his denials are very sort of incomplete.
Yeah. We'll see how this proceeds. Josh Meyer, senior investigative reporter for Politico. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, the fighting in Afghanistan continues nearly 16 years after the U.S. invaded that country. The Defense Department will deploy 300 Marines to Helmand Province by the end of this month. The Taliban recaptured a strategic district in the province a couple weeks ago. Many Afghan refugees displaced by the war have settled in the United States. Carmel Del Shad of Here and Now contributor WAMU has the story of one Afghan family's first few weeks in America and the people who are helping them.
She said, I don't know which one is better for us, you know?
Okay. Hashmatullah Rasuli and his wife are seated at the dining table in their Maryland home. The couple recently arrived from Afghanistan with their two kids. Their two-year-old son squirms in his mother's lap as they begin a one-month cultural orientation session.
Is your ESL class helping you?
Yes, ESL class is helping, yes.
At the end of the table, caseworker Tanya Vidusagavulu sits with papers in hand. She's with Lutheran Social Services of the National Capital Area, the organization that's helping the Rasulis resettle in America. She asks Hashmatullah and his wife about their address, phone numbers, and who to call in case of an emergency. They pause before answering. The couple is still getting used to American phone numbers and American addresses.
Yeah, it seems like you guys are doing fine. I would just, you know, emphasize both of you memorize your numbers, each other's numbers. Besides that, you should...
30-year-old Hashmatullah worked as an interpreter with U.S. forces in Afghanistan for about 8 years. But after people he knew were killed by the Taliban, he became worried about his family's safety and decided to leave. That's also why he doesn't want us to use the names of his wife or kids in the story. It took about 2 years to get visas to the U.S.
And that's the cupboard that they're going to put all the files on that.
Hashmatullah shows me around the family's home. The Rasulis live in a two-bedroom apartment in the basement of a tidy red brick house. Two couches in the living room are separated by a blue and green rug. There's a bright playroom for the kids and a large bedroom where the family sleeps.
That's the bed for my daughter.
In the kitchen, Hashmatullah points to his fridge, which is stocked with all the essentials.
Do you cook a lot?
Yes, I cook a lot.
On the night they arrived, a neighbor brought traditional Afghan food from a local restaurant for dinner. It was a little bit of home, thousands of miles away.
We are thinking that we are in Afghanistan. We are not thinking that we are in the United States, because all the things is like the same when I was in Afghanistan. The rices, the meats, the breads, the vegetables.
Hashmatullah says his family wants for nothing, thanks to his neighbors and the social service program that pairs faith groups with newly resettled families. They call it the Good Neighbor Program, and Hashmatullah says he's grown close to its members. One literally lives down the street.
We were very relieved that they were finally coming.
Catherine Tobias and the other Good Neighbors had been preparing for the Rasuli family's arrival for weeks. As soon as they knew the Rasulis were coming, they started searching for housing. Tobias found a neighbor with an empty basement and an open mind.
It needed quite a bit of work. It didn't have heating, and it needed a lot of work in terms of adding tile to the floor and so on.
She says a lot of thought went into making the Rasulis' new home welcoming.
Throws and candles and flowers and things on the wall and toys for the children and tablecloths and nice-looking furniture that lightly used for the most part.
The group's help doesn't end at aesthetics. Tobias says the Capitol Hill Good Neighbors are also paying for childcare, cell phones, and the family's first year of rent, as both Hashmatullah and his wife look for work. She says seeing the Rasuli family experience so many firsts is like looking through a new lens.
You know, we don't always every day get to see somebody experiencing things for the first time. And that is very lovely to watch. I care a lot about them now.
Yeah, I'll see. Kathy, good neighborhood. She's coming out.
Hello.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
How are you?
Good to see
good
you.
To see you.
Yeah. I just feel like I have this whole new branch of my family here.
I can't believe it's only been 6 weeks that I know you.
Even my kids, they like her, you know, because they say, where's my auntie? Auntie, they call him auntie.
Hashmatullah points to an American flag that hangs on the wall. It's a gift from another member of the Good Neighbor program, and the welcome note is embroidered at the top.
Welcome, Rasuli family, to the United States, January 17, 2017.
Hashmatullah explains why he's chosen to hang it in the most visible part of his living room.
Because I like this flag, because we work, we serve for this flag.
And now, Hashmatullah and his family live where this flag hangs high every day. For Here and Now, I'm Carmel Dalshad.
And we reported here on the death of American UN worker Michael Sharp last month in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was killed along with his Swedish colleague and their Congolese interpreter, presumably by the rebels they were hoping to talk out of fighting. A tragic loss for Sharp's friends and family and for the Mennonite community. Before he worked for the UN, Sharp worked with the Mennonite Central Committee, making him part of a long tradition of Mennonite humanitarian work. Now, we interestingly have two stories today regarding Mennonites. And we start with Bruce Campbell Jans, Executive Director of the Mennonite Central Committee's East Coast region. Bruce, to Michael's death, we're very sorry for your loss.
Yeah, thank you for those words. We're all on a journey, and especially Michael's parents, John and Michelle. We're on a journey together.
Yeah. Dealing with his death, you know, for people who may not know, we think of Mennonites, many lump them with the Amish, you know, people who live simply and raise barns. But that's probably inappropriate. What are Mennonites?
That's an excellent question. It reaches back to the 16th century, the Protestant Reformation in Europe, and there was this group of radical reformers, as they were called at the time, and out of that movement in Switzerland and Germany and the Netherlands was born the Anabaptist movement, the rebaptizers, because one of the tenets of Anabaptism is baptizing adults on their own confession of faith rather than baptizing infants. So that was kind of the movement, the birth of this broad Anabaptist movement, which includes Mennonites, Amish, other related groups, Church of the Brethren, Brethren in Christ, et cetera. So it reaches back 500 years, but into today, about 1.5 million Mennonites globally, more Mennonites now in the global south than there are in places like Europe and North America. So it's a movement, and I think many people would think of Mennonites, would think of the tradition of nonviolence, wanting to take Jesus's word seriously from the New Testament about loving our enemies. And I think certainly with the life of Michael, we saw some of that being willing to take a risk of your own life in order to work for peace and justice.
You told us about wanting to, you know, live the life of Jesus, turning the other cheek.
Right.
That's not simple, you know.
Yeah,
but is it based simply in that? Is that truly it? I mean, down to this is what we believe, and so we're going to go out and do humanitarian work to try to talk people or listen people out of violence?
Well, I mean, clearly there are people who become skilled practitioners in what we like to call conflict transformation as opposed to conflict resolution in many Anabaptist circles, as we both parties are transformed through the way that we work at conflict together. And that's part of Michael's life in building these relationships that then enable people to take those risky choices of putting arms aside. A very early Anabaptist leader from the Netherlands was Menno Simons, the person that actually gave the name or from whom the name Mennonite is derived. And he has a famous statement that we sort of learn growing up in the Mennonite church. We even have a song we sing with words where he talked about true evangelical faith cannot lie dormant. It clothes the naked, it feeds the hungry, it comforts the sorrowful. So it's very much – that's echoing the words of Christ in Matthew 25. So clearly there's a clear foundation in our faith for our work of nonviolence, but we see it clearly as trying to be like Jesus would be language that that would often be used in Mennonite circles.
Is it also about conversion? Just to be clear, there are faiths that send people abroad as missionaries. That's their mission. I'm thinking of the Mormons who, part of their faith, they go and travel and try to bring people to their faith, the faiths that go and knock on doors. Is that part of this? You know, people would sometimes bristle at the idea of a bait and switch. You know, somebody's gone to pull a fighter out of the jungle, but is it really to convert them to the faith?
Right. Well, I mean, clearly there would be Mennonite Anabaptist organizations which do plant churches and do evangelism. As I said, there are vibrant local churches in those contexts that are doing a lot of that work in these days in any case. So we're trying to reduce violence, reduce harm, and help people rebuild their lives and live lives of dignity. And there's no particular expectation of the future that person has in terms of their path. Again, we work out of our Christian motivation. That is our call. But again, we work with folks to try and find all people. And we believe that God wants all people in the world to live lives of dignity. And so we try to walk that path with people on the journey.
Yeah.
And many, I should also say, one of the things I really want to underline is that, you know, Michael's death is something we focus on here, as we should. But even just in the last several months, hundreds of people have lost their lives in the Kasai regions as part of the conflict that Michael got enwrapped in there. You know, we believe that the vision that God has for all of God's children is lives of dignity. How do we walk with people so that they can approach those lives of dignity that we all cherish for ourselves? So that's, I think, the call.
Well, again, we are so sorry for your loss. And, you know, the loss of his life, as terrible as it is, but it's certainly brought a lot of attention to the problem that he was trying to help fix.
Yeah. We remember Michael and remember his sacrifice, and again, the sacrifice of many other courageous and dedicated folks working in these ways, Congolese folks in this context as well, and many others on this journey.
That's Bruce Campbell-Jantz, Executive Director of the Mennonite Central Committee's East Coast Region. Bruce, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, there's also a Mennonite project here in the U.S. Have you seen those yard signs sprouting like tulips with messages like "All are welcome here" or "Hate has no home here"? Different groups are behind them, but one, the Welcome Your Neighbor signs, was started by Pastor Matthew Bucher at the Emmanuel Mennonite Church in Harrisonburg, Virginia. They've now distributed more than 50,000 signs to all 50 states and some Canadian provinces. Some organizations, in turn, sell them and donate the money to local nonprofits. And Pastor Bucher joins us now from Harrisonburg, Virginia, by Skype. Pastor, what started this for you?
In 2015, I was watching one of the early presidential primary debates and was very disappointed and angered by the rhetoric against newcomers to the country or folks in the country who were deemed unworthy to be here in the United States. I took an idea to our congregation of what would it take to put a visible sign in front of our church saying, no matter where you're from, we're glad you're our neighbor. In our neighborhood, we have a lot of folks who speak English, Spanish, and Arabic. So that's the reason we put the sign in three languages. And we got a great response from the congregation, and we put it out in September 2015.
And what are some of the sentiments on the signs? I mentioned a couple, but...
So our sign, it says, no matter where you're from, we're glad you're our neighbor, which for us is a teaching from Jesus that we should love our neighbor as ourselves.
Well, as we just heard, Mennonites are an Anabaptist denomination of the Christian faith. Believe baptism is legitimate when someone chooses it, so it's largely adult baptism that's Anabaptist, but also very peace-oriented. We have spoken here about the loss of a Mennonite in Congo, Michael Sharp. He was killed while trying to bring fighters out of the jungle. But I'm wondering, since you are a Christian and you follow the tenets of Jesus, do you worry that a side effect of the sign is that it could further divide neighbors who maybe disagree on immigration and that maybe it will seem like a slap in the face to them? I mean, they may feel that they're welcoming and they don't hate, but they just feel that there are too many undocumented immigrants in the country. I mean, did you hear what I'm saying? That it may not seem as much a sign of love to them.
I think this is one of the reasons I'm so glad that the sign often has words on both sides, that it is a symbol of hope to folks who maybe feel at the margins. But it's also a challenge, firstly, to us as followers of Jesus to say, you know, how do we care for those who are closest to us? And I think that starts with listening. It doesn't mean proving that we are, you know, hospitable enough by forcing something, but listening and learning from our neighbors, whether they are new to the country or whether they've lived in the country for hundreds of years.
Well, and that's what Michael Sharp was doing. He wasn't going to people who already agreed with him about peace. He was going to fighters, some of whom killed him. I mean, so are you also doing outreach to people who might be big President Trump supporters who might feel alienated by your signs?
I think that is the challenge. I think one of the challenges, are we willing to listen to people who disagree with us? In terms of Michael Sharp, he was willing to go and eat with people who disagreed with him very strongly. And so here in Harrisonburg, I think some of the best conversations I've had are with people who have disagreed with the signs, and being able to sit and listen to each other and trying to transform conflict through listening, through, you know, creative peacemaking.
You know, I asked about the conflict that it might be causing. On the other hand, have you already seen a positive outcome from the signs?
One of the really powerful results of these signs have been the stories that we heard. Stories of people who deliver food, so thankful, and connections being made by the people who ordered the food. We've heard stories from folks who've just arrived in the country and feeling a sense of welcome from these signs. Myself, in Harrisonburg, I bike a lot, and one day I wrecked my bicycle. And when I stood up, I realized I was across from the Islamic Center in Harrisonburg, and they had one of our signs out. And it felt wonderful to see that sign as I was injured on the side of the road. And I think we've heard lots of stories like that that show that the signs are facing outward, but also challenging people who put up the signs to live this way. And that's a really, you know, hopeful message.
Well, we hear the trains going by there in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and want you to get back to your good work. Pastor Matthew Bucher of the Emmanuel Mennonite Church, his program, The Welcome Your Neighbor Signs, will link you up at hereandnow.org. If you're interested. Pastor, thank you.
Thank you, and have a good day.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And before we get back to the show, I'd like to ask you about you. That's right. At Here and Now, we want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous, it's easy, and it'll take less than 10 minutes to complete. Just go to wbur.podcastingsurvey.com to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.podcastingsurvey.com. The survey will be very helpful to us, so thanks. Uber is losing yet another top manager. Rachel Whetstone, the company's head of policy and communications, is leaving Uber after 2 years. In a statement, she said she was incredibly proud of the team that she's built and that a strong and brilliant woman will take her place. That woman is her deputy, Jill Hazelbaker, and the change comes amid an investigation into sexual harassment at Uber and criticism of the management there. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. She joins us from New York with more on this. Hi, Lynette.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well, and we just had Uber president Jeff Jones leave last month, as did the vice president for product growth. What do we know about why Rachel Whetstone is leaving?
There are rumors flying around Silicon Valley that she was having issues with top management, and some investors have been talking about that. But, you know, it's not surprising to see people exit the company. They've been going through a lot of problems over the last month. One thing is this lawsuit. Google, her former employer, is suing Uber for allegedly taking technology from the company. And then,
right,
of course, there was the, you know, delete Uber hashtag controversy after Uber increased its fares during the immigration protests at airports across the country. And there was, of course, the company's CEO joining Trump's council of CEOs and then eventually leaving it after pressure from his riders and users, etc. And all of this is taking a toll on all kinds of employees at the company, not just senior level management, but also, you know, engineers around Silicon Valley are putting pressure on their fellows not to join Uber. So in general, that's bad for the company.
So probably not a great time for the company to lose its top PR person, but also
absolutely not.
What about the bottom line for Uber? How is the company doing financially amid all of this?
Well, remember that it's private, so we are not exactly sure how the company is doing, but what we know from leaks is that it doesn't make any money. But that's not really the game here. The game is growth with all these rideshare services. They're trying to dominate the market, and then eventually, after one company dominates, kind of one ring to rule them all, then that company will be expected to turn a profit for its investors. And so far, Uber has been a leader in that match. And so when you have horrible scandals like the ones that have been going down, especially hashtag delete Uber, that only gives share to its competitors like Lyft and more recently Juno.
And we see that Lyft just announced it raised $600 million in new funding, bringing its total funding to around $2.5 billion. That is far less than Uber, but still a lot. Is Lyft the main beneficiary of Uber's missteps?
Sure. I mean, whoever's next in the pack and can show that they're taking share in markets is going to be more attractive to Silicon Valley investors. And Uber seems to have a culture problem that Lyft doesn't have, you know, and that comes from the top down. That comes from CEO Travis Kalanick, who has had to say, don't worry, I'll grow up after, you know, he was caught on video yelling at a driver who was just asking him about why the fees that he was getting paid were going down.
Right.
I mean, Kalanick seems to be just a giant baby. I mean, he told people that he would grow up. He's 40. You know, he has this kind of frat boy element to him that people criticize Silicon Valley for. In fact, he's the worst that Silicon Valley has to offer.
Hmm. Well, we'll leave it right there. And by the way, Travis, if you want to come on and defend yourself against Lynette's charges here, we'll welcome you anytime. Lynette Lopez.
I'd love it too.
Business Insider, thank you.
Thanks.
White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer is apologizing again today after what he said yesterday during his press briefing, that what Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is doing in his country with chemical weapons is worse than what Adolf Hitler did in World War II. Let's listen.
You know, you had a, you know, someone as despicable as Hitler who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons.
When a reporter gave him a chance to clarify that comment, given that Hitler did use chemical weapons to murder millions of Jews in concentration camps, Spicer said this.
I think when you come to sarin gas, there was no, he was not using the gas on his own people the same way that Assad is doing. I mean, there was clearly, I understand your point. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. There was not in the, he brought him into the, to the Holocaust Center. I understand that. But I'm saying in the way that the Assad used them, where he went into towns, dropped them down to innocent into the middle of towns.
Sean Spicer has since apologized for those comments. And joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Jeremy.
So, I mean, it's just unbelievable to listen to that clip. But he apologized last night on CNN. And then he also talked about his comments this morning at a speaking event in Washington. Let's listen.
I made a mistake. There's no other way. I mean, there's no other way to say it. I got into a topic that I shouldn't have, and I screwed up. It's a very holy week for both the Jewish people and the Christian people, and this is not to make a gaffe and a mistake like this is inexcusable and reprehensible. And so, of all weeks, this was not. This compounds that kind of mistake.
David, your thoughts on the comments and the apology?
Well, I'm not going to offer any apology for your playing the apology that ensued from his apology. Let me just say this was he himself has called it. I believe we just heard him say that it was inexcusable and reprehensible. Usually those are words that somebody else says just before they call for you to resign, right? The real problem in some ways, he mentioned at one point this was a gaffe. This was offensive. I'm Jewish. I don't think you have to be Jewish to be offended by what he had to say. And I think from the outpouring of criticism that you saw across the political spectrum and from folks online, you could see that that wasn't the case. You know, this was something in some ways when he said the word gaffe, a gaffe has been defined in Washington as revealing something you actually think. This administration has proven to be often – quite insensitive to Jews who have real reservations about some of the folks appointed to the administration and some of the messaging, some of the rhetoric that Mr. Trump used on the campaign trail or that was embraced by his campaign in his endeavor to win the White House. And to fumble this badly, to misspeak in such a clear way, to there are even incidental terms when he talked about you know, whether or not the Syrian dictator gassed his own people as though somehow German Jews were not Germans. You know, there were ways in which it seemed to trivialize and in almost dehumanize what Jewish people went through during the Holocaust and World War II. This is something that the note of contrition that Spicer struck, I must say, seemed genuine today. And that in and of itself is a rarity for this administration, which tells you something as well.
Well, what do you think about his job security at this point? Is he going to stay on? Can a press secretary stay on when they create such a problem themselves?
You know, this is something that, you know, often press secretaries have a shelf life of, call it a year and a half to 2 years in White Houses these days, because they have to take so many arrows on behalf of the administration. They have to say so many things that involve so much spin or untruth that their credibility is compromised. You saw that a particularly glaring case with Scott McClellan, who ended up defending Bush administration officials who had, it appears, misrepresented themselves to him. But he had done so staking his own personal integrity on what he was saying in that scandal there. In this case, you know, Spicer, you know, we're only weeks into this administration, a couple months in. Spicer has said things that just aren't true and said them in the face of overwhelming, incontrovertible evidence to the contrary. And in so doing, he's represented the will of this administration. So the problem is not, you know, whether Sean Spicer is failing to be the best possible communicator for this administration. In some ways, the fear would be, the worst case scenario would be that he is the best person to do that, that there isn't somebody who could more credibly do so.
Well, and in fact,
this administration is estranged from the truth so much that it doesn't care to do so. This is a real chink. The offense that he's caused is a real moment for us to evaluate. Is he going to be able to function effectively? Credibility, I don't think he has a ton at this moment.
Well, and David, Sean Spicer wasn't even the only person to make the kind of comment that he made yesterday. Let's listen here to Defense Secretary James Mattis, who said something pretty similar.
Even in World War II, chemical weapons were not used on battlefields. Even in the Korean War, they were not used on battlefields. Since World War I, there's been an international convention on this.
I mean, it sounds, when you hear that, like this may have been a talking point for White House officials.
I think that's the case. I have seen some journalists, even some Jewish journalists, acknowledge that there is some kernel of truth there to this argument. Josh Marshall of Talking Points Memo, for example, a liberal news site. You know, there was this prohibition after the ravages and horrors of the First World War and mustard gas and things like that, this international ban on the use of it. And I think the talking point in best case scenario would be even, you know, the unmitigated horror of Hitler didn't do that thing that is specifically alleged in the case, even as he did things that were as bad by you know, astounding degrees.
Right.
But you know, that's a very tricky rhetorical case to pull off, and this administration isn't one that's proven anything like deft enough to do so.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens with Sean Spicer, but let's move on while we have you to another big story this week involving the media. United Airlines and their PR nightmare after the passenger was dragged off a plane earlier this week. Now, the plane was going to Louisville, Kentucky, and the Louisville newspaper, the Courier-Journal, published a story yesterday that dove into the criminal history of the passenger. Now, he's a doctor, but he was forced to surrender his medical license in 2005 after being convicted of drug-related charges. David, a lot of people found that pretty distasteful. Why go back into this man's history? It had nothing to do with what was going on here.
Look, I understand the impulse. You have a local paper in this case, the Courier-Journal, owned by the Gannett, to flesh out a figure that's been thrust into what became a national and international viral story. Let's define who this guy is. We know this guy. There, we've got stories in the archives about this guy. Let's detail all that we can from the public record. The problem is they treated him like a rap sheet, instead of a human being, instead of a doctor, instead of a guy with a family in their community, even if it lives you know, some miles outside of Louisville, and instead of somebody who had his face, as we now have learned, essentially introduced into the armrest of an airplane seat by law enforcement officials. You know, you saw him on tape visibly bloodied in a way that had nothing to do with what he did a decade ago. And, you know, if you were to write a fuller story, a richer story that incorporates a texture about who he is as a physician, who he is as an immigrant to this country, who he is as a family man, who he is in his community, you know, things positive and negative, then that's a fleshed out story about a human being. They treated him like a rap sheet, and I thought it was just a horrible error in judgment. Their editor-in-chief gave a statement out to the Columbia Journalism Review yesterday afternoon that I saw, in which they said, listen, he's not a new figure for our readers, so what may have seemed to an international readership that came to our website looking for more information about this story, that may have seemed fresh to them and totally out of context. We got it. I don't think that explanation holds, because if he's known to your readers because of these earlier items that landed him afoul of the law and of medical regulators in his state, then he should be easily more known to your readers as a full human being. And as you pointed out, and I think rightly from the outset, None of these things had any direct bearing on what those people knew when they dragged him off that plane. And therefore, if you're not give the full measure of the man, don't do it at all.
Okay. I have one more thing to ask you about, David, and we just have about 45 seconds left or so. But Bill O'Reilly announced last night that he is going to take a nearly two-week vacation with a planned return on April 24th. Curious timing with advertisers leaving his show in droves because of sexual harassment allegations. Some people saying this is the beginning of the end of O'Reilly. What do you think?
Even taking him at his word, this is a planned vacation that he tries to do most years around his kids' vacation break. It's an incredibly precarious moment for Bill O'Reilly. He makes so much money for that network, and he sets the table for their incredibly successful primetime broadcast every weeknight. And yet, advertisers are fleeing. They're not losing all that revenue. They're capturing most of it on other shows, but they're fleeing. It's a huge black eye. It's sustaining. They're desperately hoping it blows over. But I got to tell you, the younger Murdoch sons running the company with their father – if they need to, they'll use this as a pretext to knock the guy out.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik with a lot of media news today. David, thanks so much.
You bet.
Hillary Clinton joined New York Governor Andrew Cuomo today at LaGuardia Community College in Queens as he signed a law making the state the first to offer both 4- and 2-year public college tuition free to families making less than $100,000. There's applause and questions. Jim Molotruce was an architect of the plan. So, Jim, let's start. Some critics worry this will benefit higher-income New Yorkers because applicants have to apply for federal money like Pell Grants first, and higher-income applicants won't be eligible for that.
Well, here's the thing. In New York, we already have a very robust tuition assistance program, and nothing changes, especially for our low-income students. In fact, they are able to use what we call the tuition assistance program, the TAP program in New York State, plus other programs, not only to pay for tuition, but also to pay for other fees, books, and living expenses.
Well, that's another criticism of the Excelsior program, that it just pays for the tuition. It doesn't pay for books, fees, food, housing, and other incidentals. And there are kids who might get it and then still not be able to afford to go to school.
Here's the beautiful thing. All money is green. When you take a benefit of free tuition, that's about $25,000 a year for a 4-year student. That reduces a student's overall cost in New York State for college about a third. In some of these cases, some of the kids aren't even graduating or going to school just because there's a small gap in funding. It's just a few thousand dollars sometimes. By closing the gap, even with tuition, that lowers the overall cost of college. And by the way, the savings in the governor's plan for a 4-year student happens to be the same as what the average student loan debt coming out of college in New York State is. It's about $29,000 is the average student loan debt. You're giving a benefit of at least $25,000 for 4-year schools. So if you put that all together, that's real tangible savings for kids and families across the state.
Another requirement, you have to attend full time and finish on time. And critics say just 34% of freshmen at public universities graduate within 4 years. They sometimes have to take off to work. But another requirement is that you must stay in the state. Or if you don't stay and become a part of the New York workforce, the full grant becomes a loan. You have to pay it back.
So let me get to the first part first. There's been studies. There was a recent one by the Teachers College at Columbia University that found that students who go to school full time do better and they end up actually graduating on time. Part of what this program is aiming to incentivize is graduating kids on time. The fact that only 9% of our students graduate community colleges on time, or only about 40% graduate 4-year schools on time, this is a way to say to those students, we'll give you that last mile, that last dollar, in order to close the gap, in order to graduate on time, because that saves the overall cost. And that is probably one of the most important provisions in the governor's program.
Let me get to some other criticism, because again, it's, you know, you're getting a lot of applause, but you've got an assemblyman, a Democrat, James Skoufis, who says it's more sizzle than substance, and he's pointing to the idea that this is only going to benefit 32,000 of the 1.3 million students in the State University of New York. This is SUNY, the SUNY system. And that actually, in addition to the grant program, there's an across-the-board raise in tuition. So he says it's a little bit of a sleight of hand.
Well, it's not a sleight of hand. It works all together. It's a very progressive structure, which I think the assemblyman values himself a progressive. Even if you take his assumption that it is only 30,000 kids, well, that's 30,000 families that potentially couldn't go to college and give themselves a better chance at life. The state already is about giving about $1 billion of tuition assistance out to families all across the state. So we're doing a lot. So hardly it's just sizzle. It's a lot of stake there, and it's something to be proud of. And it is a national model, because the fact of the matter is, it's no longer a luxury to get a college degree. It's a necessity. If you want to make it in the workforce, if you want to make it in the job market, you have to get a college degree.
Governor Cuomo has been saying that it's comparable to high school now. The way high school was made free because you had to go to high school, he feels the same about the community colleges there. Let me just ask you one question, Jim. Is there some kind of a requirement before you can get this? Are you worried about people flocking to New York to get free college?
No, I mean, listen, there's at least 100,000 unfilled jobs in New York State. The reason is that you need more highly educated people to fill those jobs. We don't want to be importing our workforce from other states or other nations like we have to do now. We want to be educating our students here so they can stay here and work here. And that is something to be proud of and something to applaud. And you can always fix these little technical things if they arise. But we don't look at people in the most cynical way as some others do. We look at them in the positive light.
That's Jim Malatras, president of the Nelson Rockefeller Institute of Government, and until recently part of the government of New York, where he helped develop the new Excelsior Scholarship Program, free four-year college tuition, two-year as well, to people who qualified. Jim, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.